The pill ducked back into its section. On Kratt's main screen appeared the hollow image of a man and several dolphins. From the man's shape, Kratt could tell it was a female, probably their leader. Stupid creatures unworthy of the name Sophants. Foolish presentient upspring of errant masters. We slip away from all your armed might, laughing at your clumsiness. We slip away as we always will, you pathetic creatures. And now that we have a real head start, you'll never catch us. What better proof that the progenitors favor not you, but us? What better proof? The taunt went on. Kratt listened, enraged, yet at the same time savoring the artistry of it. These men are better than I'd thought. Their insults are wordy and overblown, but they have talent. They deserve honorable, slow deaths.
Mistress, the Tandu with us are changing course. Their other ships are leaving Kithrop for the transfer point.
Kratt hissed in despair.
After them! After them at once! We've followed them through space this far. The chase only goes on.
The crew bent to their tasks resignedly. The Earth ship was in a good position to escape. At best, this would be a long chase. Kratt realized that she would never make it home in time for mating. She would die out here. On her screen, the man continued to taunt them.
Librarian, she called. I do not understand some of the man's words. Find out what that phrase, nyah-nyah, means in their beastly wolfling tongue.
Chapter 124. Tom Orley. Cross-legged on a woven mat of reeds, shaded by a floating wreck, he listened as a muttering volcano slowly sputtered into silence. Contemplating starvation, he listened to the soft, wet sounds of the endless weedscape, and found in them a homely beauty. The squishy, random rhythms blended into a backdrop for his meditation. On the mat in front of him, like a focus mandala, lay the message bomb he had never set off. The container glistened in the sunlight of North Kithrop's first fine day in weeks. Highlights shone in dimpled places where the metal had been battered, as he had been. The dented surface gleamed still. Where are you now? The subsurface sea waves made his platform undulate gently. He floated in a trance through levels of awareness, like an old man poking idly through his attic. Like an old-time hobo looking with mild curiosity through the slats of a moving boxcar. Where are you now, my love? He recalled a Japanese haiku from the 18th century by the great poet Yosa Buson. As the spring rains fall, soaking in them, on the roof, is a child's rag ball. Watching blank images in the dents on the side globe, he listened to the creaking of the flat jungle, its skittering little animal sounds, the wind riffling through the wet, flat leaves. Where is that part of me that has departed? He listened to the slow pulse of a world ocean, watched patterns in the metal, and after a while, in the reflections in the dents and creases, an image came to him. A blunt, bulky wedge shape approached a place that was a not place, a shining blackness in space. As he watched, the bulky thing cracked open. The thick carapace slowly split apart like a hatching egg. The shards fell away, and there remained a slender, nubbed cylinder, looking a bit like a caterpillar. Around it glowed a nimbus, a thickening shell of probability that hardened even as he watched. No illusion, he decided. It cannot be an illusion. He opened himself to the image, accepting it, and from the caterpillar, a thought winged to him. Blossoms on the pear, and a woman in the moonlight reads a letter there. His slowly healing lips hurt as he smiled,
It was another haiku by Busan. Her message was as unambiguous as could be under the circumstances. She had somehow picked up his trance poem and responded in kind.
Jill,
he cast as hard as he could. The caterpillar shape, sheathed in a cocoon of stasis, approached the great hole in space. It dropped forward toward the knot place, grew transparent as it fell, then vanished. For a long time, Tom sat very still, watching the highlights on the metal globe slowly shift as the morning passed. Finally, he decided it wouldn't do him or the universe any harm if he started doing something about survival. Chapter 125. The Skiff.
Between you two crazy males, have you come any closer to figuring out what he's talking about?
Kipiro and Sao just stared back at Hikaki. They turned back to their discussion without answering her, huddling with Kraidaiki, trying to interpret the captain's convoluted instructions. Hikaki rolled her eyes and turned to Toshio.
You'd think they'd include me in these seances of theirs. After all, Kraidaiki and I are mates.
Toshio shrugged.
Kraidaiki needs Sao's language skill and Kipiru's ability as a pilot. But you saw their faces. They're halfway into the whale dream right now. We can't afford to have you that way while you're in command.
Hmm. Hikaki spumed, only slightly mollified.
I suppose you've finished the inventory, Toshio?
Yes, sir, he nodded. I have a written list ready. We're well enough stocked in consumables to last to the first transfer point, and at least one beyond that. Of course, we're in the middle of nowhere, so we'll need at least 5 transfer jumps to get anywhere near civilization. Our charts are pitifully inadequate. Our drives will probably fail over the long haul, and few ships our size have even taken transfer points successfully. Aside from all that, and the cramped living quarters, I think we're all right.
Hikaki sighed. We can't lose anything by trying. At least the galactics are gone.
Yeah, he agreed. It was a nice stroke, Jillian taunting the ETs at the last minute. It let us know they got away and got the ETs off our backs.
Don't say ETs, Toshio. It's not polite. You may offend some nice Kantan or Linton one day if you get into the habit.
Toshio swallowed and ducked his head. No matter where or when, no lieutenant had ever been known to slacken off on a MIDI.
Yes, sir, he said.
Hikaki grinned and flicked a small splash of water on the youth with her lower jaw. Duty, duty, brave shark biter, what reward could taste better? Toshio blushed and nodded. The skiff started to move again. Kipiru was back in the pilot's saddle. Kraidaiki and Sao chattered excitedly in a semi-primal rhythm, which still sent shivers down Hikahi's spine. And Saud had said that Kraidaiki was toning it down on purpose. She was still getting used to the idea that Kraidaiki's injury might have been a door opening rather than a closing. The skiff lifted from the sea and began to speed eastward, following Kraidaiki's hunch.
What about passenger morale? Hikaki asked Toshio.
Well, I guess it's all right. That pair of Kikui are happy so long as they're with Denny. And Denny's happy. Well, she's happy enough for now.
Hikaki was amused. Why should the youth be embarrassed about Denny's other preoccupation? She was glad the two young humans had each other, as she had Kraidaiki. In spite of his new eerie side, Kraidaiki was the same dolphin. The newness was something he used, something he seemed only to have begun exploring. He could hardly speak, but he conveyed his great intellect and his caring in other ways.
What about Charlie? She asked Toshio.
Toshio sighed.
He's still embarrassed. They had found the chimp a day after the great earthquakes, clinging to a floating tree trunk, sopping wet. He had been unable to speak for 10 hours, and had kept climbing the walls in the skiff's tiny hold until he finally calmed down. Charlie finally admitted that he had scrambled to the top of a tall tree just before the island blew. It had saved his life, but the stereotype mortified him. Toshio and Hikaki crowded in behind Kipiru's station and watched as the ocean rolled swiftly beneath the skiff. For minutes at a time, the sea turned a brilliant green as they passed over great swatches of vine. The little boat sped toward the sun. They had been searching for almost a week, ever since Streaker had departed. First found had been Toshio, swimming purposefully westward, never giving up. Then Denny had led them to another island where there was a tribe of Kikwi. While she negotiated another treaty, they searched for and found Charles Dart. Takata Jim's Stenos were all missing or dead. After that had come one last, and apparently forlorn, search. They had been at this last phase for several days now. Hikaki was about to give up. They couldn't go on wasting time and consumables like this, not with the journey they had ahead of them. Not that they really had much of a chance. No one had ever heard of a voyage like they planned. A cross-galactic journey in the skiff would make Captain Bly's epic crossing of the Pacific in the Bounty's longboat seem like an afternoon jaunt. She kept her appraisal to herself, though. Krydike and Kipiru probably understood what lay ahead of them. Toshio seemed to have guessed part of it already. There was no reason to inform the others until they had to cut the rations for the fourth time. She sighed. Of what else are heroes made than men and women who, like us, try? Kipiru's fluting call of triumph was like a shrill trumpet. He squalled and tossed on his platform. The skiff rolled left and right in a wiggle-waggle, then went into a screaming climb. "What the f—" Toshio stopped himself. "Holy jumping turtlefish, Kipiru! What is it?" Hikaki used a harness arm to grab a wall stanchion and looked out a port. She sighed for a third time, long and deep. The smoke from his fire momentarily hid the boat from sight. The first he knew of it was the sonic boom that rolled over him, nearly knocking over his drying racks. The human standing on the woven reed mat almost dove for cover, but a hunch made him stop and look up instead. His eyes were sun-squinted. Crow's feet that had not been there a few weeks before lay at the corners. His beard was black with thin gray flecks. It had grown out and nearly stopped itching, almost covering a ragged scar that ran down one cheek. Shading his eyes, he recognized the wild maneuvers before he did the outlines of the tiny ship. It streaked high into the sky and looped about, coming back to screech past him again. He reached out to steady the drying racks against the thunder. No sense in letting the meat go to waste. It had taken a lot of work to harvest it, strip it, and prepare it. They might need it for the voyage ahead. He wasn't sure how the Fen would take to the stuff, but it was nourishing, the only food on the planet that an Earthling could eat. Gubru jerky, tandu strips, and flayed episiarch would never make it into haute cuisine, of course, but perhaps they were an acquired taste. He grinned and waved as Kipiru finally calmed down enough to bring the skiff to a halt nearby. "How could I have ever doubted he'd still be alive?" Hikaki wondered joyfully. Jillian said he had to live. None of the galactics could ever touch him. How could they? And why, in the wide universe, was I ever worried about getting home? Postscript. Dolphin names often sound as if they are Polynesian or Japanese.
In some cases, this is true. In general, however, the Neofin chooses for a name a sound he likes, usually a polysyllabic word with strong alternating vowels and consonants. In Anglic, the words man, men, and mankind apply to humans without reference to gender. On those occasions when gender is important, a female human is referred to as a femme, and a male human as a male. Dolphin languages are the author's invention and are not meant to represent the communication of natural dolphins and whales today. We are only beginning to understand the place of the cetaceans in the world, and we are just beginning to understand our own. The author wishes to thank all those who helped with this work, with their advice and criticism and encouragement, especially Mark Grigier, Anita Everson, Patrick Marr, Rick and Patty Harper, Ray Feist, Richard Spall, Ethan Munson, and, as always, Dan Brin. Lou Aronica and Tapan King of Bantam Books were most helpful with encouragement when morale was lowest. The translated haiku by Yosa Buson were from an anthology of Japanese literature, compiled and edited by Donald Keen, published by Grove Press. The world's many paths diverge in both reality and imagination. The creatures of this novel are all fanciful, but it may happen that some of our fellow mammals will one day be our partners. We owe it to that possible future to let their potential survive. David Brin, August 1982. Epilogue. Rest. Rest and listen. Rest and listen and learn, cried Ikey. For the star tide rises in the currents of the dark, and we have waited long for what must be.
The end. You've been listening to Star Tide Rising by David Brin, narrated by George Wilson. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.